as if this fact concerned him personally. But the Scythi knew their land. They were close to it, a part of it even, in a way that the invaders could never be. They held their own for a long time, falling slowly back on places of strength. The chiefest of these, and the reason for this whole discourse, was Aswa, the Hayholt.
This castle? The Scythi lived in the Hayholt? Simon wasn't able to keep the disbelief out of his voice. How long ago was it built?
Simon, Simon!
The doctor scratched his ear and returned to his perch on the table. The sunset was completely gone from the windows, and the torchlight divided his face into a mummer's mask, half illumined, half dark.
There may, for all I or any mortal can know, have been a castle here when the Scythi first came, when Austin Ard was as new and unsullied as a snow-melt brook. Scythi folk certainly dwelled here countless years before man arrived. This was the first place in Austin Ard to feel the work of crafting hands. It is the stronghold of the country commanding the waterways, riding herd on the finest croplands. The Hayholt and its predecessors, the older citadels that lie buried beneath us, have stood here since before the memories of mankind. It was very, very old when the Rimmersmen came.
Simon's mind whirled as the enormity of Morgaini's statement seeped in. The old castle seemed suddenly oppressive, its rock walls a cage. He shuddered and looked quickly around, as though some ancient jealous thing might even at this moment be reaching out for him with dusty hands. Morgaini's laughed merrily, a very young laugh from so old a man, and hopped down from the table. The torches seemed to glow a little brighter.
Fear not, Simon. I think, and I of all people should know, that there is not much for you to fear from Scythi magic. Not today. The castle has been much changed, stone laid over stone, and every ell has been rigorously blessed by 100 priests. Oh, Judith and the cooking staff may turn around from time to time and find a plate of cakes missing, but I think that can be as logically ascribed to young men as to goblins.
The doctor was interrupted by a short series of raps upon the chamber door.
"Who is it?"
he cried.
"It's me," said a doleful voice. There was a long pause. "Me. Inch," it finished.
"Bones of a Nexus," swore the doctor, who favoured exotic expressions. "Open the door, then. I am too old to run about waiting on fools."
The door swung inward. The man framed against the glow of inner hallway was probably tall, but hung his head and hunched his body forward in such a way that it was difficult to make sure. A round, vacant face floated like a moon just above his breastbone, thatched by spiky black hair that had been cut with a dull and clumsy knife.
"I'm sorry I bothered you, Doctor, but you said come early, now didn't you?"
The voice was thick and slow as dripping lard. Morgaini's gave a whistle of exasperation and tugged on a coil of his own white hair.
"Yes, I did, but I said early after the dinner hour, which has not yet arrived. Still, no sense in sending you away. Simon, have you met Inch, my assistant?"
Simon nodded politely. He had seen the man once or twice. Morgaini's had him coming in some evenings to help, apparently with heavy lifting. It certainly wouldn't be for anything else, since Inch did not look as though he could be trusted to piss on the fire before going to bed.
"Well, young Simon, I'm afraid that will have to put an end to my windiness for the day," the old man said. "Since Inch is here, I must use him. Come back soon, and I will tell you more, if you like."
"Certainly."
Simon nodded once more to Inch, who rolled a cow-like gaze after him. He had reached the door, almost touched it, when a sudden vision blazed into life in his head. A clear picture of Rachel's broom, lying where he had left it, on the grass beside the moat, like the corpse of a strange water bird.
Mooncalf!
He would say nothing. He could collect the broom on his way back and tell the dragon that the chore was finished. She had so much to think about, and although she and the doctor were two of the castle's oldest residents, they seldom spoke. It was obviously the best plan. Without understanding why, Simon turned back. The little man was scrutinizing a curling scroll, bent over the table while Inch stood behind him, staring at nothing particular.
Dr. Morganis.
At the sound of his name, the doctor looked up, blinking. He seemed surprised that Simon was still in the room. Simon was surprised, too.
Doctor, I've been a fool.
Morganis arched his eyebrows, waiting.
I was supposed to sweep your room. Rachel asked me to. Now the whole afternoon has gone by.
Oh. Ah.
Morganis' nose wrinkled as if it itched him. Then he broke out a wide smile.
Sweep my chamber, eh? Well, lad, come back tomorrow and do it. Tell Rachel that I have more work for you, if she will be so good as to let you go.
He turned back to his book, then looked up again, eyes narrowing, and pursed his lips. As the doctor sat in silent thought, the elation Simon was feeling changed suddenly to nervousness.
Why is he staring at me like that?
Come to think of it, boy, the man finally said. I will be having many chores coming up that you could help me with, and eventually I will need an apprentice. Come back tomorrow, as I said. I will talk with the mistress of chambermaids about the other.
He smiled briefly, then turned back to his scroll. Simon was suddenly aware that Inch was staring across the doctor's back at him, an unreadable expression moving beneath the placid surface of his whey-colored face. Simon turned and sprinted through the door. Exhilaration caught him up as he bounded down the blue-lit hallway and emerged under dark, cloud-smeared skies.
Apprentice to the doctor!
When he reached the gatehouse, he stopped and climbed down to the edge of the moat to look for the broom. The crickets were well into the evening's chorale. When he found it at last, he sat down for a moment against the wall near the water's brink to listen. As the rhythmic song rose around him, he ran his fingers along the nearby stones, caressing the surface of one worn as smooth as hand-burnished cedar. He thought,
this stone may have been standing here since before our Lord Osiris was born. Perhaps some Scythi boy once sat here in this same quiet place, listening to the night. Where did that breeze come from?
A voice seemed to whisper
the words too faint to hear.
Perhaps he ran his hands across this same stone.
A whisper on the wind.
We will have it back, man-child. We will have it all back.
Clutching the neck of his coat tight against the unexpected chill, Simon got up and climbed the grassy slope, suddenly lonesome for familiar voices and light. Chapter 3. Birds in the Chapel.
By the blessed Aidan, whack, and Elysia his mother, whack, whack, and all the saints that watch over, whack, watch over, ouch,
a hiss of frustration,
damn spiders.
The whacking resumed, curses and invocations laid on between. Rachel was cleaning cobwebs from the dining hall ceiling. Two girls sick and another with a twisted ankle. This was the kind of day that put a dangerous glint in Rachel the dragon's agate eye. Bad enough to have Sarah in jail down with affliction. Rachel was a hard taskmistress, but she knew that every day of working a sick girl could mean losing her 3 days in the longer run. Yes, bad enough that Rachel had to pick up the slack left by their absence. As if she did not do two people's work already. Now the seneschal said the king would dine in the great hall tonight, and Elias, the Prince Regent, had arrived from Merrimond, and there was even more work to do. And Simon, sent off an hour before to pick a few bundles of rushes, was still not back. So here she stood, with her tired old body perched on a rickety stool, trying to get the spiderwebs out of the ceiling's high corners with a broom. That boy! That Holy Aiden, give strength! Whack, whack, whack! That damnable boy! It was not enough, Rachel reflected later as she slumped red-faced and sweaty on the stool, that the boy was lazy and difficult. She had done her best over the years to thump the contrariness out of him. He was certainly a better person for it, she knew. No, by the good Mother of God, what was worse was that no one else seemed to care. Simon was man-tall, and at an age when he should be doing nearly a man's work. But no, he hid and slid and mooned about. The kitchen workers laughed at him, the chambermaids coddled him, and snuck dinner to him when she, Rachel, had banished him from table. And Morgaine's, merciful Elysia, the man actually encouraged him. And now he had asked Rachel if the boy could come and work for him every day, sweeping up, helping to keep things clean, ha, and assisting the old man with some of his work. As if she didn't know better. The two of them would sit about, the old souse guzzling ale, and telling the boy heaven knew what kind of devil stories. Still, she couldn't help considering his offer. It was the first time anyone had asked for the boy, or wanted him at all. He was so underfoot all the time. And Morgaine's had really seemed to think he could do the boy some good. The doctor often irritated Rachel with his fancy talk and his flowery speeches, which the mistress of chambermaids felt sure were disguised mockery. But he did seem to care about the boy. He had always kept an eye out for what was best for Simon. A suggestion here, an idea there, a quiet intercession once when the master of scullions had thrashed him and banished him from the kitchens. Morgaine's had always kept a watch on the boy. Rachel looked up at the broad beams of the ceiling, her gaze travelling off into the shadows. She blew a strand of damp hair off her face. Starting back on that rainy night, she thought, what was it, almost 15 years ago? She felt so old thinking back this way. It seemed only a moment. The rain had been sheeting down all day and night. As Rachel went gingerly across the muddy courtyard, holding her cloak over her head with one hand, the lantern in the other, she stepped in a wide wagon rut and felt the water splash her calves. Her foot came free with a sucking sound, but without a shoe. She cursed bitterly and hurried forward. She would catch her death running around on such a night with one foot bare, but there was no time to go digging about in puddles. A light was burning in Morgaine's study, but it seemed to take forever for the footsteps to come. When he opened the door, she saw that he had been abed. He wore a long nightshirt in need of mending, and rubbed his eyes groggily in the lantern glare. The tangled blankets of his bed, surrounded by a leaning palisade of books in the room's far corner, made Rachel think of some foul animal's nest.
"Doctor, come quick," she said. "You must come quick, now."
Morgaine stared, then stepped back.
"Come in, Rachel. I have no idea what nocturnal palpitations have brought you, but since you are here..."
"No, no, you foolish man. It's Susanna. Her time is here, but she is very weak. I'm afraid for her."
"Who? What? Never mind, then. Just a moment, let me get my things. What a dreadful night. Go on, I shall catch up to you."
"But Dr. Morgaine's, I brought the lantern for you."
Too late. The door was closed, and she was alone on the step with rain dribbling off her long nose. Cursing, she splashed back to the servants' quarters. It was not long before Morgaine's was stamping up the stairs, shaking the water from his cloak. At the doorway, he absorbed the scene in a single glance. A woman on the bed with her face turned away, big with child and groaning. Dark hair lay across her face, and she squeezed in a sweaty fist the hand of another young woman who kneeled beside her. At the foot of the bed, Rachel stood with an older woman. The old one stepped toward Morgaine's while he shed his bulky outer clothing.
"Hello, Elizabeth," he said quietly. "How does it look?" "Not good, I'm afraid, sir. You know I could have dealt with it otherwise. She's been trying for hours, and she's bleeding. Her heart is very faint."
As Elizabeth spoke, Rachel moved nearer. Morgaine's bent and rummaged in the sack he had brought.
"Give her some of this, please," he said, handing Rachel a stoppered vial. "Just to swallow, but mind she gets it."
He returned to searching his bag as Rachel gently pried open the clenched, trembling jaw of the woman on the bed and poured a little of the liquid into her mouth. The odor of sweat and blood that suffused the room was suddenly supplemented by a pungent, spicy scent.
"Doctor," Elizabeth was saying as Rachel returned, "I don't think we can save both mother and child, if we can even save one." "You must save the child's life," Rachel interrupted. "That's the duty of the God-fearing. The priest says so. Save the child."
Morgaine's turned to her with a look of annoyance.
"My good woman, I will fear God in my own way. If you don't mind, if I save her, and I do not pretend to know I can, then she can always have another child." "No, she can't," Rachel said hotly. "Her husband's dead."
Morgaine's of all people should know that, she thought. Susanna's fisherman husband had often visited the doctor before he drowned, although what they might have had to talk about, Rachel could not imagine.
"Well," Morgaine said distractedly, "she can always find another. What? Her husband?"
A startled look came to his face, and he hurried to the bedside. He seemed to finally realize who it was lying there, bleeding her life out on the rough sheet.
"Susanna?"
he asked quietly, and turned the woman's fearful, pain-clenched face toward him. Her eyes opened wide for a moment as she saw him, then another wave of agony shut them again.
"Ah, what has happened here?"
Morgaine sighed. Susanna could only moan, and the doctor looked up at Rachel and Elizabeth with anger on his face.
"Why didn't anyone inform me that this poor girl was ready to bear her child?" "She was not due for 2 months more," Elizabeth said gently. "You know that. We are as surprised as you."
"And why should you care that a fisherman's widow was going to have a baby?" Rachel said. She could be angry too.
"And why are you arguing about it now?"
Morgaine stared at her for a moment, then blinked twice.
"You are absolutely correct," he said, and turned back to the bed. "I will save the child, Susanna," he told the shivering woman.
She nodded her head once, then cried out. It was a thin, keening wail, but it was the cry of a living baby. Morgaine's handed the tiny, red-smeared creature to Elizabeth.
"A boy,"
he said, and returned his attention to the mother. She was quiet now and breathing more slowly, but her skin was white as Harcher marble.
"I saved him, Susanna. I had to," he whispered.
The corners of the woman's mouth twitched. It might have been a smile.
"I know," she said,
voice coming ever so softly in her raw throat.
"If only my Aelferend had not..."
The effort was too much, and she stopped. Elizabeth leaned down to show her the child, wrapped in blankets, still attached by the bloody umbilicus.
"He's small," the old woman smiled, "but that's because he arrived so early. What is his name?" "Call him Seoman,"
Susanna croaked out.
"It means waiting."
She turned to Morgaine's and seemed to want to say something more. The doctor leaned closer, his white hair brushing her snow-pale cheek, but she could not make the words come. A moment later she gasped once and her dark eyes rolled up until the whites showed. The girl holding her hand began to sob. Rachel too felt tears come to her eyes. She turned away and pretended to begin cleaning up. Elizabeth was severing the infant's last tie to his dead mother. The movement caused Susanna's right hand, which had been tightly tangled in her own hair, to sag free and drop limply to the floor. As it struck, something shiny flew from her clutching palm and rolled across the rough boards to stop near the doctor's foot. From the corner of her eye, Rachel saw Morgani stoop down and pick the object up. It was small and disappeared easily into the palm of his hand, and from there into his bag. Rachel was outraged, but no one else seemed to have noticed. She whirled to confront him, teardrops still standing in her eyes. But the look on his face, the terrible grief, stilled her before she breathed a word.
"He will be Seoman," the doctor said,
his eyes strange and shadowed now as he moved closer, his voice hoarse.
"You must take care of him, Rachel. His parents are dead, you know."
A swift intake of breath. Rachel had caught herself just before she slipped off the stool. Nodding off in bright daylight, she was ashamed of herself. Then again, it only went to show the criminal length to which she had driven herself today, all in an effort to make up for the three girls off. And for Simon. What she needed was a little fresh air. Up on a stool, swatting the broom around like a madwoman. No wonder a body started in getting in the vapors. She'd just step outside for a moment. The Lord knew she had every right to a little fresh air. That Simon, such a wicked boy. They'd raised him, of course, she and the chambermaids. Susanna hadn't any kinfolk nearby, and no one seemed to know much of anything about her drowned husband, Aelferund, so they kept the boy. Rachel had pretended to raise a fuss over it, but she would no more have let him go than she would have betrayed her king, or left beds unmade. It was Rachel who had given him the name Simon. Everyone in the service of King John's household took a name from the king's native island, Warinsten. Simon was the closest to Seoman, and so Simon it was. Rachel went slowly down the stairs to the bottom floor, feeling just a little shaky in the legs. She wished she'd brought a cloak, as the air was bound to be nippy. The door creaked open slowly. It was such a heavy door, needed the hinges oiled most likely, and she walked out into the entry yard. The morning sun was just nosing over the battlement, peeping like a child. She liked this spot. Just underneath the stone span that connected the dining hall building with the main body of the chapel. The little courtyard in the shadow of the span was full of pine trees and heather, all set about on small sloping hills. The whole garden was not more than a stone's throw in length. Looking up past the stone walkway, she could see the needle-slim thrust of Green Angel Tower, shining white in the sunlight like an ivory tusk. There had been a time, Rachel remembered, long before Simon came, when she herself had been a girl playing in this garden. How some of those maids would laugh to think of that, the dragon as a little girl. Well, she had been. And after that, a young lady, not unpleasant to look at either, and that was only the truth. The garden then had been full of the rustle of brocade and silk, of lords and ladies laughing with hawks on their fists and a merry song on their lips. Now Simon, he thought he knew everything. God just made young men stupid, and that was that. Those girls had nearly spoiled him beyond redemption, and would have if Rachel hadn't kept her eye out. She knew what was what, even if these young ones thought otherwise.
Things were different once, Rachel thought.
And as she thought it, the pine smell of the shaded garden seemed to catch at her heart. The castle had been such a beautiful, stirring place. Tall knights, plumed and shiny mailed, and beautiful girls in fine dresses. The music, oh, and the tawny field all jewel bright with tents. Now the castle slept quietly and only dreamed. The towering battlements were commanded by Rachel's kind, by cooks and chambermaids, seneschals and scullions. It was a little chilly. Rachel leaned forward, hugging her shawl tighter, then straightened up, staring. Simon stood before her, hands hidden behind his back, How on earth had he managed to slip up on her that way? And why did he have that idiot grin smeared across his face? Rachel felt the strength of righteousness come surging back into her body. His shirt, clean an hour before, was blackened with dirt and torn in several places, as were his breeches.
"Blessed Saint Riap, save me!" Rachel shrieked. "What have you done, you fool boy?"
Riap had been an Adonite woman of Naban, who had died with the name of the one god on her lips after being repeatedly violated by sea pirates. She was a great favorite with domestics.
"Look what I have, Rachel," Simon said, producing a tattered, lopsided cone of straw, a bird's nest.
It gave off faint chirps.
"I found it underneath Hjeldin's tower. It must have blown off in the wind. Three of them are still alive, and I'm going to raise them." "Are you utterly mad?"
Rachel lifted her broom on high, like the vengeful lightnings of the Lord that had surely destroyed Riap's ravishes.
"You are no more going to raise those creatures in my household than I am going to swim to Perdruin. Filthy things flying around getting in people's hair. And look at your clothes. Do you know how long it will take Sarah to patch all that?"
The broomstick quivered in the air. Simon cast his eyes down. He had not found the nest on the ground, of course. It was the one he had spotted in the hedge garden, partially dislodged from its seat in the festival oak. He had climbed up to rescue it, and in his excitement at the thought of having the young birds for his own, he had not given a thought to the work he was making for Sarah, the quiet, homely girl who did the downstairs mending. A wave of gloom and frustration washed over him.
"But, Rachel, I remembered to pick the rushes."
He balanced the nest carefully and pulled from beneath his jerkin a meager, bedraggled clump of reeds. Rachel's expression softened somewhat, but the scowl remained.
"It's just that you don't think, boy. You don't think. You're like a little child. If something gets broken or something is done late, someone has to take responsibility for it. That's the way the world is. I know you mean no real harm, but must you be so, by Our Lady, stupid?"
Simon looked up cautiously. Although his face still showed sorrow and contrition in proper measure, Rachel, with her basilisk eye, could see that he thought he was through the worst of it. Her brow rebeetled.
"I'm sorry, Rachel, truly I am," he was saying, when she reached out and poked his shoulder with her broom handle. "Don't you come to the old sorry with me, lad. Just you take those birds out of here and put them back. There'll be no flapping, flying creatures round these parts." "Oh, Rachel, I could keep them in a cage. I could build one." "No, no, and once more means no. Take them and give them to your useless doctor if you want, but don't bring them round to trouble honest people who have work to do."
Simon trudged off, the nest cupped in his hands. He had made a miscalculation somewhere. Rachel had almost given in, but she was a tough old stork. The slightest error in dealing with her meant swift, terrible defeat.
"Simon!"
she called. He whirled.
"I can keep them?" "Of course not! Don't be a moon calf!"
She stared at him. An uncomfortably long time passed. Simon shifted from foot to foot and waited.
"You go work for the doctor, boy," she said at last. "Maybe he can squeeze some sense into you. I give up."
She glowered at him.
"Mind you do what you're told, and thank him. And what little luck you have left for this one last chance, understand?" "Yes, certainly,"
he said happily.
"You're not escaping from me all that easily. Be back at dinner hour." "Yes, mistress."
Simon turned to hurry off to Morgani's, then stopped.
"Rachel, thank you."
Rachel made a noise of disgust and marched back towards the stairs to the dining hall. Simon wondered how she had gotten so many pine needles stuck in her shawl. A gentle mist of snow had begun to float down from the low, tin-colored clouds. The weather had turned for good, Simon knew. It would be cold right through to Candlemancer. Rather than carry the baby birds across the windy courtyard, he decided to duck through the chapel and continue through to the western side of the inner bailey. Morning prayers had been over for an hour or two, and the church should be empty. Father Dreyosen might not look kindly on Simon tramping through his lair, but the good father was undoubtedly entrenched at table with his usual large mid-morning meal, humming ominously at the quality of the butter or the consistency of the honey and bread pudding. Simon climbed the 24 steps up to the chapel's side door. The snow had started to flurry. The grey stone of the doorway was dotted with the wet residue of dying flakes. The door swung back on surprisingly silent hinges. Rather than leave telltale wet footprints across the tile floor of the chapel, he pushed through the velvet hangings at the back of the entry chamber and climbed another set of stairs to the choir loft. The cluttered, stuffy loft, a steaming misery box during high summer, was now pleasantly warm. The floor was strewn with bits of the monks' leavings, nutshells, an apple core, scraps of slate roof tiles on which messages had been written in petty contravention of the silence vows. It looked more like a cage for apes or festival bears than a room where men of God came to sing the Lord's praises. Simon smiled, threading his way quietly among the various other oddments strewn about. Bolts of plain cloth, a few small flimsy wooden stools. It was nice to know that those dour-faced, shaven-headed men could be as unruly as farm boys. Alarmed by the sudden sound of conversation, Simon stopped and edged back into the wall hanging that blanketed the rear of the loft. Crushed into the musty fabric, he held his breath as his heart raced. If Father Dreyosen or Barnabas the sexton were below, he would never make his way down and out the far door unobserved. He would have to sneak back out the way he had come, using the courtyard route after all, the master spy in the enemy's camp. Squatting, silent as cotton wool, Simon strained to locate those who spoke. He seemed to hear two voices. As he concentrated, the birdlings peeped quietly in his hands. He balanced the nest carefully for a moment in the crook of his elbow, while he pulled off his hat. More woe to him if Father Dreyosen should catch him hatted in the chapel, then slid the soft brim down over the top of the nest. The chicks went promptly silent, as if night had fallen. Parting the edges of the hanging with trembling care, he leaned his head out. The voices were rising from the aisle below the altar. Their tone seemed unaltered. He had not been heard. Only a few torches were lit. The vast roof of the chapel was almost entirely painted in shadow, the shining windows of the dome seeming to float in a nighttime sky. Holes in the darkness through which the lines of heaven could be seen. His foundlings capped and delicately cradled, Simon crept forward on noiseless feet to the rail of the choir loft, positioning himself at the shadowy end nearest the staircase descending to the chapel proper. He poked his face between the carved rails of the balustrade, one cheek against the martyrdom of St. Tunath, the other rubbing the birth of St. Pelipa of the island. "And you, with your God-be-cursed complaining," one of the voices railed. "I have grown unutterably tired of it." Simon could not see the speaker's face. His back was to the loft, and he wore a high-collared cloak. His companion, however, slumped across from him on a pew bench, was quite visible. Simon recognized him at once. "People who are told things they do not want to hear often call such tidings complaining, brother," said the one on the bench, and waved a slim-fingered left hand wearily. "I warn you about the priest out of love for the kingdom." There was a moment's silence. "And in memory of the affection we once shared." "You may say anything, anything you wish to," the first man barked, his anger sounding strangely like pain. "But the chair is mine by law and our father's wish. Nothing you think, say, or do can change that." Joshua Lackhand, as Simon had often heard the king's younger son called, pushed himself stiffly up from the bench. His pearl-grey tunic and hose bore subtle patterns of red and white. He wore his brown hair cropped close to his face and high upon his forehead. Where his right hand should have been, a capped cylinder of black leather protruded from his sleeve.
I do not want the dragonbone chair. Believe that, Elias, he hissed. His words were soft-spoken, but they flew to Simon's hiding place like arrows. I merely warn you against the priest Priorates, a man with unhealthy interests. Do not bring him here, Elias. He is a dangerous man, believe me, for I know him of old from the Usirian seminary in Naban. The monks there shunned him like a plague carrier. And yet you continue to give him your ear, as though he were trustworthy as Duke Iskrimnor or old Sir Fluirin. Fool, he will be the ruin of our house. He composed himself. I seek only to offer a word of heartfelt advice to you. Please believe me. I have no designs on the throne.
Then leave the castle, Elias growled,
and turned his back on his brother, arms crossed on his chest.
Go, and let me prepare to rule as a man should, free of your complaints and manipulation.
The older prince had the same high brow and hawk-like nose, but was far more powerfully built than Joshua. He looked like a man who could break necks with his hands. His hair, like his riding boots and tunic, was black. His cloak and hose were a travel-stained green.
We are both our father's sons, O king-to-be.
Joshua's smile was mocking. The crown is yours by right. The griefs we bear against each other need not worry you. Your soon-to-be royal self will be quite safe. My word on that. But, his voice gained force, I will not, do you hear me, will not be ordered out of my sire's house by anyone. Not even you, Elias. His brother turned and stared. As their eyes met, it seemed to Simon a flash of swords.
Griefs we bear against each other, Elias snarled,
and there was something broken and agonized in his voice.
What grief can you bear against me? Your hand?
He walked away from Joshua a few steps and stood with his back to his brother, his words thick with bitterness.
The loss of a hand. Because of you, I stand a widower, and my daughter half an orphan. Do not speak to me of grief.
Joshua seemed to hold his breath for a time before replying. Your pain is known to me, brother, he said at last. Do you not know I would have given not just my right hand, but my life? Elias whirled, reaching a hand to his throat, and pulled something glittering from out of his tunic. Simon gaped between the railings. It was not a knife, but something soft and yielding, like a swatch of shimmering cloth. Elias held it before his brother's startled face for a sneering moment, then threw it to the floor, pivoted on his heel, and stalked away up the aisle. Joshua stood motionless for a long moment, then bent like a man in a dream to pick up the bright object. A woman's silver scarf. As he stared, its gleam cupped in his hand, a grimace of pain or rage twisted his face. Simon breathed in and out several times before Joshua at last tucked the thing into the breast of his shirt and followed his brother out of the chapel. A lengthy interval had passed before Simon felt safe to creep down from his spying place and make his way to the chapel's main door. He felt as though he had witnessed a strange puppet show. An Usiris play enacted for him alone. The world suddenly seemed less stable, less trustworthy if the princes of Erkinland, heirs to all of Austin Ard, could shout and brawl like drunken soldiers. Peering into the hall, Simon was startled by a sudden movement. A figure in a brown jerkin hurrying away up the corridor. A small figure, a youth of perhaps Simon's age or less. The stranger flicked a glance backward, a brief glimpse of startled eyes, and then was gone around the corner. Simon did not recognize him. Could this person have been spying on the princes, too? Simon shook his head, feeling as confused and stupid as a sunstruck ox. He pulled his hat off the nest, bringing daylight and chirping life back to the birds. Again, he shook his head. It had been an unsettling morning. Chapter 4. Cricket Cage. Morghenis was rattling about his workshop, deeply engaged in a search for a missing book. He waved Simon permission to find a cage for the young birds, then went back to his hunt, toppling piles of manuscripts and folios, like a blind giant in a city of fragile towers. Finding a home for the nestlings was more difficult than Simon had expected. There were plenty of cages, but none seemed quite right. Some had bars so widely spaced that they seemed built for pigs or bears. Others were already crammed full of strange objects, none of which resembled animals in the least. Finally, he found one that seemed suitable, beneath a roll of shiny cloth. It was knee-high and bell-shaped, made of tightly twisted river reeds, empty but for a layer of sand on the bottom. There was a small door on the side, held closed by a twist of rope. Simon worried the knot loose and opened it.
"Stop! Stop that this instant!"
"What?" Simon leaped back. The doctor hopped past him and pushed the cage door shut with his foot.
"Sorry to alarm you, boy," Morghenis panted, "but I should have thought before sending you off to dig and muck about. This is no good for your purposes, I'm afraid."
"But why not?" Simon leaned forward, squinting, but could see nothing extraordinary.
"Well, my grub, stand here for a bit and don't touch, and I'll show you. Silly of me not to have remembered."
Morghenis cast about for a moment until he found a long-ignored basket of dried fruit. He blew the dust off a fig as he walked to the cage.
"Now, observe carefully."
He opened the door and tossed in the fruit. It landed in the sand on the cage bottom.
"Yes?"
asked Simon, puzzled.
"Wait,"
whispered the doctor. No sooner had the word passed his lips than something began to happen. At first it seemed that the air in the cage was shimmering. It quickly became apparent that the sand itself was shifting, eddying delicately around the fig. Suddenly, so suddenly that Simon jumped backward with a surprised grunt, a great toothy mouth opened in the sand, gulping the fruit as swiftly as a carp might break the surface of a pond to take a mosquito. There was a brief ripple along the sand, and then the cage was still again, as innocent seeming as before.
"What's under there?" Simon gasped.
Morghenis laughed.
"That's it."
He seemed very pleased.
"That's the beastie itself. There is no sand. It's just a masquerade, so to speak. The whole thing at the bottom of the cage is one clever animal. Lovely, isn't it?"
"I suppose so," said Simon, without much conviction. "Where does it come from?"
"Nascado, out in the desert countries. You can see why I didn't want you poking about in there. I don't think your feathered orphans would have had a very happy time of it either."
Morghenis shut the cage door again, binding it closed with a leather thong, and placed it on a high shelf. Having climbed onto his table to accomplish this, he then continued along its great length, stepping expertly over the litter, until he found what he wanted and hopped down. This container made of thin strips of wood held no suspicious sand.
"Cage for crickets," the doctor explained,
and helped the youth move the birds into their new home. A small dish of water was placed within. From somewhere else, Morghenis even produced a tiny sack of seeds which he scattered on the cage floor.
"Are they old enough for that?" Simon wondered.
The doctor waved a careless hand.
"Not to worry," he said. "Good for their teeth."
Simon promised his birds that he would be back soon with something more suitable, and followed the doctor across the workshop.
"Well, young Simon, charmer of finch and swallow," Morghenis smiled. "What can I do for you this cold forenoon? It seems to me that we had not completed your just and honorable frog transaction the other day, when we were forced to stop."
"Yes, and I was hoping—"
"And I believe there was another thing, too."
"What?" Simon thought hard.
"A little matter of a floor in need of sweeping. A broom, lone and lorn, aching in its twiggy heart, to be put to use."
Simon nodded glumly. He had hoped an apprenticeship might start on a more auspicious note.
Ah, a small aversion to menial labour?
The doctor cocked an eyebrow.
Understandable, but misplaced. One should treasure those humdrum tasks that keep the body occupied but leave the mind and heart unfettered. Well, we shall strive to help you through your first day in service. I have thought of a wonderful arrangement.
He did a funny little jig step.
I talk, you work. Good, eh?
Simon shrugged. Do you have a broom? I forgot mine. Morgani's poked around behind the door, producing at last an object so worn and cobwebby it was scarcely recognizable as a tool for sweeping.
Now,
the doctor said, presenting it to him with as much dignity as if it were the king's own standard.
What do you want me to talk to you about?
About the sea raiders and their black iron, and the city, and our castle, of course, and King John.
Ah, yes, he nodded thoughtfully. A longish list. But if we are not once again interrupted by that cloth-headed sluggard Inch, I might be able to whittle it down a bit. Set to, boy, set to, let the dust fly. By the by, where exactly in the story was I?
Oh, the Rimmersmen had come, and the Scythi were retreating, and the Rimmersmen had iron swords, and they were chopping people up, and killing everyone, killing the Scythi with black iron.
Hmm, said Morgainis dryly. It comes back to me now. Hmm, well, truth be told, the northern raiders were not killing quite everybody. Neither were their expansions and assaults quite so relentless as I may have made them sound. They were many years in the north before they ever crossed the Frostmarch. Even then they ran into a major obstacle, the men of Hernestia.
Yes, but the Scythi folk... Simon was impatient. He knew all about the Hernestiri, had met many people from that pagan western land. You said that the little people had to flee from the iron swords.
Not little people, Simon. I... Oh, my.
The doctor slumped down onto a pile of leather-bound books and pulled at his sparse chin whiskers.
I can see that I must give this story in greater depth. Are you expected back for the midday meal?
No, Simon lied promptly. An uninterrupted story from the doctor seemed a fair bargain for one of Rachel's fabled thrashings.
Good. Well then, let us find ourselves some bread and onions, and perhaps a noggin of something to drink. Talking is such thirsty work. Then I shall endeavour to turn dross to purest metal absolute. In short, to teach you something.
When they had provisioned themselves, the doctor once more took a seat.
Well and well, Simon. Oh, and don't be bashful about wielding that broom while you eat. The young are so flexible. Now correct me, please, if I misspeak. The day today is Draws Day, the 15th. 16th? No, 15th of November. And the year is 1164, is it not?
I think so.
Excellent. Do put that over on the stool, will you? So... the 1164th year since what? Do you know?
Morgainis leaned forward. Simon pulled a sour face. The doctor knew he was a moon calf and was teasing him. How was a scullion supposed to know about such things? He continued to sweep in silence. After some moments he looked up. The doctor was chewing, staring at him intently over a crusty chunk of dark bread. What sharp blue eyes the old man has. Simon turned away again.
Well then,
the doctor said around a mouthful,
since what?
I don't know, Simon muttered, hating the sound of his own resentful voice.
So be it, you don't know, or you think you don't. Do you listen to the proclamations when the crier reads them?
Sometimes, when I'm at market. Otherwise, Rachel tells me what they say.
And what comes at the end? They read the date at the end, do you remember? And mind that crystal urn, boy, you sweep like a man shaving his worst enemy. What does it say at the end?
Simon, nettled with shame, was about to throw the broom down and leave, when suddenly a phrase floated up from the depths of his memory, bringing with it market sounds, the wind snapping of pennants and awnings, and the clean smell of spring grass strewn underfoot. Since the founding, he was sure, he heard it as though he was standing on Main Row.
Excellent!
The doctor lifted his jar, as if in salute, and knocked back a long swallow.
Now, the founding of what? Don't worry, he continued as Simon began to shake his head. I'll tell you. I don't expect young men these days, raised as they are on apocryphal errantry and derring do, to know much of the real substance of events.
The doctor shook his own head, mock sadly.
The Nabonae Imperium was founded, or declared to be founded, 1160, whatever it was, years ago, by Tiagaris, the first imperator. At that time, the legions of Naban ruled all the countries of men, north and south, on both sides of the River Glenywent.
But Naban is small, Simon was astonished. It's just a small part of King John's kingdom.
That, young man, Morgaini said, is what we call history. Empires have a tendency to decline, kingdoms to collapse. Given 1,000 years or so, anything can happen. Actually, Naban's zenith lasted considerably less than that. What I was getting to, however, is that Naban once ruled men, and men lived side by side with the Scythi folk. The king of the Scythi reigned here in Aswa, the Hayholt, as we call it. The Earl King, Earl is an old word for Scyther, refused humans the right to enter his people's lands, except by special grant. And the humans, more than a little afraid of the Scythi, obeyed.
What are Scythi? You said they're not the little folk. Morgaini smiled.
I appreciate your interest, lad, especially when I haven't put in killing or maiming once yet today. But I would appreciate it even more if you were not so shy with the broom. Dance with her, boy, dance with her. Look, clean that off, if you will.
Morgaini's trotted over to the wall and pointed to a patch of soot several cubits in diameter. It looked very much like a footprint. Simon decided not to ask, and instead set to sweeping it loose from the white plastered stone.
Ah, many thanks to you. I've been waiting to get that down for months, since last year's Harrow's Eve, as a matter of fact. Now, where in the name of the lesser Vistrals was I? Oh, your questions. The Scythi. Well, they were here first, and perhaps will be here when we're gone, when we're all gone. They are as different from us as man is from the animal, but somewhat similar, too.
The doctor stopped to consider.
To be fair, man and animal both live a similarly brief span of years in Austin Ard, and this is not true of Scythi and man. If the fair folk are not actually deathless, they are certainly much longer lived than any mortal man, even our nonagenarian king. It could be they do not die at all except by choice or violence. Perhaps if you are a Scyther, violence itself might be a choice.
Morgaini's trailed off. Simon was staring at him, open-mouthed.
Oh, shut that jaw, boy. You look like Inch. It's my privilege to wander in thought a little bit. Would you rather go back and listen to the mistress of chambermaids?
Simon's mouth closed, and he resumed sweeping the soot off the wall. He had changed the original footprint shape to something resembling a sheep. He stopped from time to time to eye it appraisingly. An itch of boredom made itself known at the back of his neck. He liked the doctor, and would rather be here than anywhere else, but the old man did go on so. Maybe if he swept a little more of the top part away, it would look like a dog. His stomach growled quietly. Morgaini's went on to explain in what Simon thought was perhaps unnecessary detail, about the era of peace between the subjects of the ageless Earl King and those of the upstart human imperators.
So, Scythi and man found a sort of balance, the old man said. They even traded together a little.
Simon's stomach rumbled loudly. The doctor smiled a tiny smile and put back the last onion, which he had just lifted from the table.
Men brought spices and dyes from the southern islands, or precious stones from the Greenspoke Mountains in Hernestir. In return, they received beautiful things from the Earl King's coffers, objects of cunning and mysterious workmanship.
Simon's patience was at an end.
But what about the shipmen, the Rimmer's men? What about the iron swords?
He looked about for something to gnaw on. The last onion? He sidled cautiously over. Morgainis was facing the window. While he gazed out at the grey noontide, Simon pocketed the papery brown thing and hurried back to the wall spot. Much diminished in size, the splotch now looked like a serpent. Morgainis continued without turning away from the window.
I suppose there has been quite a bit of peaceful times and people in my history today.
He wagged his head, walking back to his seat.
Peace will soon give way, never fear.
He shook his head again, and a lock of thin hair settled across his wrinkled forehead. Simon gnawed furtively at his onion.
Naban's golden age lasted a little over 4 centuries, until the earliest coming of the Rimmer's men to Austin Ard. The Nivenae Imperium had begun to turn in on itself. Tiagaris' line had finally died out, and every new imperator who seized power was another cast of the dice cup. Some were good men who tried to hold the realm together. Others, like Crexus the Goat, were worse than any